would you say is the most important book in the Bible? Now, if you were going to say the most important book, that's an easy one. It's the Bible. But of the 66 books, which one do you think is the most important? There's lots of different ways you could answer that. You could answer what your favorite book is. I had somebody several weeks ago out of the blue ask me what my favorite book is. And I must admit, I'm always amazed that as we're going through the different books in the Bible, how that particular book just comes alive. And nearly any one of them could be my favorite book. But I'm a Paul guy. I love his logical approach to life. I would say if I had to choose a favorite, it would probably be Ephesians because it's kind of a miniature Romans. But that's my favorite book. That's not necessarily the most important. You could go to your easiest book, the one that you enjoy reading the most. Maybe that would be Genesis with all the stories, or 1 Samuel with the giants, or Daniel with the all kinds of great stories. But what would be the most important? Now, you could argue God gave us 66. He doesn't want us to choose one. And that would be a fair argument. But just stick with me for a second. If you had to choose one, which one would you choose? May I suggest if I had to choose one, I think I would choose the one before us this morning. Because no other book in the Bible is going to give us a more balanced view of Jesus' birth, of his life, of his teaching, of his miracles, of his death, of his resurrection, than the Gospel of Matthew. We began last year going through these 66 books, trying to figure out a way to get through all of them. And really, we began by suggesting that the Bible really is a big story. It's not a section of numerous stories. It talks about how God made everything, and he made it for good, and put all in this garden, and he created the zenith of his creation, human beings, and he placed them in the garden, and everything was good until something went terribly wrong. Evil entered. And soon humanity was redefining good and evil, and suddenly this evil split humanity and turned us against each other. It cursed the world, and we were suffering from all kinds of problems. And really the rest of the Bible is this discussion of the tremendous impact that evil has had on all of us. But finally we get to the good news. The good news is really a person. One who has come to make all things new, to give us an opportunity to see what new creatures look like, and then to take that news that has transformed us to a world that desperately needs it. That's the story of the Bible. We began clear back looking at those several books in the Bible, the Old Testament books, as we call them, divided into a number of groups, the historical books, beginning with Genesis and long through Deuteronomy, we see Moses, and then we enter the books of history, beginning with Joshua and going all the way to the very end, and then we come to the books of the heart, the books of poetry, books like Psalms, where you get to hear the feelings of David as much as the theology of David. But then I must admit, the part that has really been a struggle for me are the prophets. The prophets can largely be summarized in a single word: repent or else. And they experience the or else. But finally, we come to the New Testament, and as we get to the New Testament, we're going to be introduced to the life of the one who makes everything new again. We're going to see through the book of Acts how Jesus' life continues through his disciples. And as the gospel begins to spread, his apostles begin to write books or letters. We call them epistles. We're eventually going to get to the letters of Paul. They're actually arranged by size, beginning with Romans and going to Philemon. Then we're going to get to the epistles of a bunch of other individuals, apostles, James, John, and eventually end with the book of Revelation. But this morning, we find ourselves looking at these four gospels. And I must admit, there's a question that arises. Why four? I mean, if the point is to share the story of Jesus, wouldn't it make more sense to have a gospel? I mean, think about it. So there's an awful lot of effort and energy put into trying to harmonize the gospel. How do we figure out the life of Christ? Well, where does Matthew relate to Mark? Wouldn't it have been simpler just to have one? But I think the reason it's helpful to begin in Genesis is because you begin to realize that the Jews never told a good story once. If you remember back in Genesis chapter 1, it's the creation story, and Moses begins with a very systematic, chronological approach. Day 1, he made light and dark. Day 2, he separated the waters, and all the way till day 7, and he rested. And then chapter 2, he goes back, and he's not telling a new creation. He's telling the creation story from a different perspective. He's telling it centered in, not on the systematic chronology of the creation story, but focusing in on humanity and how it impacts humanity. In fact, if you remember when we were going through it, I shared that the Hebrew Old Testament is slightly different, has the same books, but they're arranged differently. There are actually only three sections in the Hebrew book. There is the law, and then there are the prophets, and then there are the books that are called the writings. And in the Hebrew Old Testament, the book of 1 and 2 Samuel was just a single scroll. And the book of Kings was also a second scroll. In our book, our Bible, we have Chronicles next. They actually put Chronicles at the very end, because the author of the Hebrew, or the collection, thought it was really important to see a review. And how does it begin? We're going to talk a little bit about genealogies this morning, and I was struck by this thought. I don't know that I'd ever had this thought before. I'm not going to condemn you. Maybe you love genealogies, and they're your thing. When I get to them, it's a chance to get caught up on my reading, because I can really make ground in a hurry. Just go over them. But imagine you live 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, before TV or the internet, before radio or even the newspaper, and you're sitting alone with your family at home on a nice Tuesday night when it isn't snowing, and what do you do? Tell me, what do you remember about Adam? What story strikes you from the life of Seth? What do you know about Enosh? How about Kenan? How about Mahalalel? Jared? Oh, here's a good one. Let's take a few minutes and think through the life of Enoch. And then there was good old Methuselah. See, I'm afraid because these names are hard to pronounce, because we have very little in relationship to understanding who they were, we just zip right past them. But I'm convinced the point of Chronicles is to retell the story. It's a great story. You can't just tell it once. And then what's really amazing to me is you get to the really important stories, like the fall of the city of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. It's found not only in Kings and in Chronicles, but Jeremiah dedicates the last chapter and a half of his book to it. My favorite story, or one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament, the story of God delivering Jerusalem from Sennacherib, king of Assyria, under Hezekiah. It's not told once or twice, but it's found in Kings, Chronicles, and Isaiah dedicates several chapters to it. Now, if you've spent time in the Old Testament, it won't shock you that the most important story ever told isn't told once or twice or three times. It's told four times. But I think there's another reason, and if you have your bulletins and you like to take notes, or even if you don't, I think it will be helpful to just take a second and kind of survey, because each of the four Gospels presents life from a slightly different perspective, a slightly different emphasis. They're written to different individuals. The Gospel of Matthew is a Jewish book. If you're going to understand Matthew, you either had to grow up under the Jewish system or do a lot of homework to understand it. You see that? Let me just pick one illustration. In chapter 15, there's this story of the disciples sitting down to eat, and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked him, "Why do you disciples break the tradition of the elders and they don't wash their hands before they eat?" Mark is the shortest of the Gospels. Mark tends to focus on the incident as short a fashion as possible. He goes from one step to the next. His favorite word is immediately. Same story. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who came from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with their hands that were quote unquote unclean, that is unwashed. What in the world does that mean? See, we miss this because washing hands to us is hygienic. It's all about getting rid of bacteria. It's not what the Jews were worried about. In fact, that's not how they washed their hands. They didn't use soap and water. They used holy water. And if you remember the context of the story, you remember that the disciples had been up in the north in the Gentile territory, touching unclean people and things. If they ate that food that they have now made unclean, because they touched it. There be unclean. And so Mark adds this note. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders when they come from the marketplace. They do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as washing of cups and pitchers and kettles and so on. See, Mark realizes if we're going to understand it, if you're not a Jew, you haven't grown up with the traditions of the elders, it kind of goes over your head. And thus, Mark is going to present his audience, not a Jewish audience, but primarily a Gentile audience. Luke is a doctor, a friend who travels most of his time with Paul. He is going to write to a Roman official. John, most of the time, you will see that John is written to the world, mostly because of verses like John 3:16, "For God so loved the world." But I have often been stymied by how in the world can a person read John without seeing the clear claim to deity? I'm convinced the answer is they're not Jews. So much of what John is going to rely upon in chapter 5, we'll get there eventually, it's going to be entirely based upon these are the three definitions of God to a Jew. And Jesus will do all three of those. If you're not a Jew, you don't see that. In fact, John is going to write an amazing demonstration, but it's from a Jewish perspective. So we have two to the Jews, two to the Gentiles. Well, they have different purposes. John is pretty easy to figure out his purpose. He clearly states it at the end of his writing. He says, "But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." The whole point of John writing everything that he's written is to defend the deity of Jesus. He's the Son of God. To defend the messianic nature of his ministry, he is the Christ, and that he is the only source of life. John's written so people will believe. Luke, on the other hand, Luke states up front, he begins in chapter 1 by saying this, "Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything," Matthew, Mark, and John were almost certainly eyewitnesses. Mark, there's a little bit of discussion, but almost certainly he saw, and he takes from Peter. Luke, on the other hand, didn't see any of the Gospels, and so he researches it. He says, "I've investigated everything from the beginning, and it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus." Theophilus was a Roman official situated probably in the city of Rome in an influential position. "Why did I write this? Not so that you'll believe, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have already been taught." You already believe. Let me try and defend them. Explain them. Luke is written so that you can understand better the things that you've already believed. Mark is the only gospel that actually uses the term gospel. Mark writes to share the good news. Matthew, I would suggest, is going back to believers who've already trusted so that they can learn better of how Jesus fulfills everything. They also present Jesus in four different manners. Now, I'm a little reluctant to say this because I don't want you to conclude that Matthew only presents Jesus as king, that he never presents him as a man, he never presents him as God. That's not the case at all. All four of the Gospels are going to present him in all four ways. However, Matthew's primary emphasis, his most important part, is that he wants everyone to see that Jesus is king. Mark is going to talk about Jesus came to seek and to save those who are lost, that he doesn't want you to serve him, he wants to serve you. Luke, he's a doctor. He presents Jesus as a man. And thus John will present him as God. But they also focus on different things. In fact, it's interesting to me that one of the issues that when you pick up a Harmony or a survey of the New Testament, they will usually spend an entire chapter on what's called the synoptic problem. The synoptic problem means Matthew, Mark, and Luke have a similar perspective. They all look at Jesus the same. So if they all look at Jesus the same, why are there slight differences? In fact, it's interesting that about 90-some percent, I think there's 664 verses in Mark, over 600 of them are repeated either in Matthew or Luke. The big difference between Mark and Matthew is Mark only shares what Jesus did. Matthew always steps back and wants you to hear what Jesus said. He shares with us the Sermon on the Mount. He'll share with us the Olivet Discourse. He'll share with us, as we're going to see in a second, five amazing sermons. Matthew wants you to make certain that you hear what Jesus said. Mark, he wants you to see what Jesus did. Luke, the ever-living physician, wants you to understand how Jesus felt. He was tired. He was hungry. He was angry. He was sad. That's how Luke presents Jesus. John's only concerned about who Jesus was. As we will eventually get there, we're going to see that the New Testament is going to break down fairly nicely along the patterns of these four Gospels. James is highly Jewish. In fact, the book of James really is a New Testament book of Proverbs, pithy statements. Mark was undoubtedly good friends with Peter. In fact, most would say that to some degree, the Gospel of Mark is the Gospel of Peter. John gets to write four more books. He's got three epistles and then the book of Revelation. The vast majority of the New Testament comes from the Pauline Luke perspective. In fact, the most prolific author in the New Testament is not Paul by words. It's Luke. But together, they write the vast majority of the New Testament. Now, you'll notice I didn't include the book of Hebrews. When we get there we're not going to get there in a second. It's not even going to be an hour or day. We'll eventually get there. I don't believe Hebrews is written by Paul, but there is no question that it was written by a Pauline disciple. It was written by somebody who spent time with Paul, because the same themes are there. With all of that said, let me just spend a second and outline the book of Matthew. It's kind of interesting. You don't find a consensus on how you should outline the book. There's kind of three different approaches. There's probably more than that, but three common ones. The first one is a geographical approach. Most of the first portion of the book of Matthew is spending time up in the north. Jesus will make Capernaum the headquarters of his ministry. It's right on the coast of the Sea of Galilee. And most of the book of Matthew's early chapters are in the north. The last part of it will come down to the south. And so some would divide it by the Galilean ministry and the Judean ministry. Another really common way is to divide it around chapter 16. And when you're going through the Gospel of Matthew, it's really hard not to park and spend an hour. And it's snowing, so I hope not to keep you here all afternoon. Or maybe I should keep you here all afternoon, then you won't have to drive in the snow. But chapter 16 is the pivotal chapter. Jesus, for the first 15 chapters, is teaching and preaching and healing. And then in chapter 16, he takes his disciples way off to the north. And Caesarea Philippi is radically different than the rest of the land in Israel. Most of the land in Israel is arid, it's dry, it's hot. Caesarea Philippi is up where the headwaters of the Jordan River begin, and it's cool, and it's green, and it's an incredible place just to get away. And Jesus takes his disciples, and in the course of the discussion, he says, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And we're not told who speaks up, but one says, "Well, some say you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead. Others say you're Elijah. Still others say Jeremiah," or they throw out a whole host of the prophets. And then Jesus asks, I would argue, the most important question all of us will have to answer. This is not just a question to his disciples. You will one day stand in front of God and answer the question, who is Jesus? And for a moment, Peter, who is notoriously good at sticking his foot in his mouth, Peter gets it. And he says, "You are the Christ." I fear, because we don't speak Hebrew, because we don't live in a first century Jewish home, the term Christ is Jesus' last name. It's Jesus Christ. Christ was perhaps the fundamental thought and hope of all of the Old Testament. It's Greek for the Hebrew word Messiah, and Messiah simply meant the anointed one, the chosen one, the one who would come and make all things good again. Peter says, "You are the Christ." But you are not just the Christ. You are the Son of the living God. what I don't think too many who studied the Old Testament saw when Messiah was promised was that a man would never do. That in order for one to fully fulfill all of the needs of Messiah, he would have to be God clothed in humanity. And Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And from that moment on, Jesus' ministry changes. In fact, it's interesting. He's going to say that, good answer, Peter. But the only way anyone can come to that conclusion is that God opened your eyes. But then beginning in verse 21, he turns his eyes away from the multitudes. And he turns his eyes to the cross. From chapter 17 through chapter 26, Jesus is going to spend way more time with his disciples. He's not going to be gathering the crowds like he did early in his ministry. He's going to be focusing his attention, probably for the last 6 months of his ministry, preparing himself and his disciples for his death. But there's one final way, and this is the way that I think if Matthew was here, this is the way he would have outlined it. If you come to the book of Matthew, he's really going to present Jesus in three ways. Jesus as Messiah, Jesus as the new Moses, and then Jesus as God among us. Why that Moses? Well, if you begin to look at the way he breaks it down, there are these two sections. The first section is the introduction with his birth. The first three chapters, the birth and then his baptism. The last three focus on his death. But in between, you have what I would suggest are five books, five messages, and they all end with exactly the same statement. When Jesus had finished saying these things, it's in chapter 7, verse 28, chapter 11, verse 1, 13, 53, 19, 1, and 26, 1. Every single time, Jesus is going to end these great sermons, or Matthew's going to end them with the words of Jesus saying, when Jesus had finished saying these things. Five sermons. The first is often called the Sermon on the Mount because Matthew is going to say Jesus went up on a mountainside and spoke. In 2009, I had the wonderful chance to go to Israel, and the land of Israel is an incredible place to visit. My favorite spot was Capernaum. Because in Capernaum, you actually get to be where Jesus was. This is the ruins of a synagogue, and you'll notice the synagogue sits on top of a black foundation. There's a sign there that tells you the white part of the synagogue was built in the 4th century. The black foundation is the very place Jesus would have gone and taught. But just a few miles up the road, there's a beautiful church called the Church of the Beatitudes. It's the traditional place of Jesus giving the Sermon on the Mount. This is my best picture of looking at the hill. I went online and I found this one. Now you got to look really hard. Right there is the Church of the Beatitudes. Does that look like a mountain to you? Now, I recognize mountains are subjective. What is a mountain in Iowa is not a mountain in Colorado. When I lived in the Twin Cities, they have the most popular ski hill in the Twin Cities is called Buck Hill. Some would call it Buck Bump. It's just a few hundred feet down. It's not a mountain, but people ski down it. It's relative. Why in the world does he call that a mountain? I would suggest he calls it a mountain because Moses gave the first law on the mountain. Jesus gives a new law on the mountain. In fact, as you begin to look at all of Jesus' discourses, he's going to send out his disciples. He's going to give the parables of the kingdom. He's going to give the rejection of the kingdom. And then finally, he's going to end with the coming of the kingdom. And I really believe that what Matthew is trying to paint is, yes, Jesus is Messiah. We'll get there in a second. Yes, Jesus is God, Emmanuel, God with us. But Jesus has come to give us a new law, a new set of rules and regulations, new commandment. I say unto you, love one another. Matthew is trying to help us see that Jesus is replacing Moses. He is fulfilling the law and giving us a new covenant. I just want to spend a second looking at the purpose of the book, and I could have shared many, but I just want to share two. I'm convinced that Matthew writes so that you will not miss that Jesus is the king. Once again, he begins with his genealogical record. I'm guessing that if you were to write the next bestseller, you wouldn't begin with 17 verses of names nobody can pronounce. You go to the movie next time, and you know that there's going to be 5 minutes of credits before the movie. What do? You slip out and you get popcorn, or you just come late. I fear that's what we do, but may I suggest if you give the genealogies a chance, there's an awful lot to learn. Matthew messes up in the first line. Do you know how genealogy works? You start in the oldest, and you go to the youngest. He is the son of who? No. Matthew, you're confused. If you're going to start at Abraham, start at Abraham. Don't start at David. Why does he start with David? Five times in the genealogy, Matthew's going to bring up the name David. Why? Because he wants you to make certain that you don't miss the point. The whole genealogical record is to provide for us the reality that Jesus is the Christ. I love the way he ends it. He doesn't say that Jesus follows Babylon. The Christ does. The genealogical record is fascinating because this was something somebody could have gone up and looked. The genealogical records were kept in the temple. And if you didn't believe that this was accurate, you could go to the temple, spend an afternoon, go through the genealogical records to find out who was the rightful heir to the throne of David. Interestingly enough, in 70 AD, the Romans will come and destroy the temple. And amidst the destruction of the temple, the genealogical records are gone forever. Messiah could not come after 70 AD because there is no way to prove that you are the rightful heir to the throne of David. But Jesus came long before anyone would have had any problem checking. But what we don't have time to go through the genealogy, but I find it really fascinating. In a Jewish perspective, it doesn't matter who your mom is. It only matters who your dad is. And yet Matthew shares four women. Tamar, who pretended to be a prostitute and slept with her father-in-law. Rahab, who was a prostitute. Ruth, who was of all things a Moabitess. If you don't remember what Moabitess was, go back and read Genesis. You'll find out it was an ancestral relationship with Lot and his daughters that produced Moab. And Bathsheba, most likely a Gentile, and most certainly an adulteress. Why in the world, if you were going to share four women, would you include those four women? Because God came to save people like me, like you, like Rahab, like Tamar, like Bathsheba. In fact, I'm convinced the genealogical record provides us with an incredible picture of God's amazing grace. And so Matthew leaps into what we think of as the birth narrative, the Christmas story. And I know that you've heard this story thousands of times. I know that we've just come through the Christmas story and you probably read it several times. But let me just take a second. It begins as Joseph finds out that Mary is pregnant. It's interesting, in Luke's account, you only hear Mary speak. In Matthew's account, you only hear Joseph speak. And Joseph only speaks to an angel, and the angel says to him that she's pregnant from the Holy Ghost, and she will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Yahshua, which is the Hebrew word for Joshua, which speaks of one who delivered. Joshua delivered from the promised land. Jesus is going to deliver from an even greater enemy, from sin. Why? All of this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said. In Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, the prophet some 700 years earlier had written, "The Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and he will call him Emmanuel," God with us. I fear because we go to chapter 2, we think the story stops. It doesn't. Matthew's intent is to continue the story. And if you miss this, he's not done with his point. It begins in verse 2 with the Magi coming from the east. And if you were here 2 weeks ago, I hope this impacts you. In 63 AD, the Romans take over what is modern-day Palestine. And what Rome did is they appointed a king. The king at this particular moment was a man by the name of Herod the Great. He is renowned for his amazing building skills, the second temple that he remade in all of its splendor. A number of places around Israel are amazing building spots that Herod made. Herod was appointed king of Israel. This child was born king of Israel. Why was Herod terrified? Because he knew he wasn't the rightful king. Why does Herod respond the way that he does? Because he cannot allow the rightful king to stand. But why was he born in Bethlehem? He was born in Bethlehem because that was exactly what the prophet Micah had said would happen. I don't have time to go back to the whole Christmas story, but to me, one of the most amazing parts of the Christmas story is God moves the heart of a pagan emperor 1,000 miles from Jerusalem to get Mary and Joseph to where they need to be. I've often wondered, why didn't Joseph and Mary go on their own? Didn't they read the Old Testament? But he gets them to Bethlehem where he's born. Why? Because that's where the prophet is written. And then after this, the angel comes to Joseph and says, Herod is going to bring great harm. He's trying to kill the child. Go where? No, this can't be right. You don't go back to Egypt. Haven't you read the Old Testament? Egypt is the summary of forsaking God. It's going the wrong direction. Not to Egypt. Why would Jesus and Joseph and Mary go to Egypt? Because that's where God said he would go. And then you continue. And when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinities who were 2 years of age and under in accordance with the time he'd been learned from the Magi. Why? Because God had promised through the prophet Jeremiah that there would be great mourning and Rachel would weep for her children. But we're still not done. He then finds out that Herod the Great dies, but his son is still over the southern part of Israel. So he goes to all places way up to the north where nobody of any significance lived. And he grows up in Nazareth. So much so that when he's claiming to be Messiah, the Pharisees will say, Messiah didn't come from Nazareth. Are you sure? It amazes me when you begin to think about it, the number of coincidences that would have had to happen. He moves the heart of an emperor 1,000 miles away. He moves the heart of a pagan, godless king to kill children, all to fulfill what he had promised hundreds of years ago. In fact, we don't have time this morning, but we could spend the rest of the morning going through passage after passage. Some 16 times Matthew will say that this happened so that it was fulfilled what the prophet said, what the law said, what the Old Testament said. Matthew wants to make certain that we do not miss Jesus came and proved he was king. But I would suggest that Matthew not only wants to present Jesus as king, he wants to challenge you to respond. Chapter 17 of Matthew is this incredible story. It's the story of what is often called the Transfiguration. Chapter 16 is the great confession of Peter. God changes the focus of Jesus to look at the cross, but before he begins towards the cross, he goes up on this mountain. And as he's on this mountain, he brings Peter, James, and John with him. Luke tells us he spends all night in prayer. They, as I suspect most of us would have done, drift off to sleep. And Peter wakes up to the brightest thing he has ever seen. Yesterday, I was shoveling my driveway, and we have a snowblower, so I decided, yeah, I'll get the snowblower out. I went into the garage, and I could barely see the snowblower. It's amazing how your eyes get blinded by the snow. The snow is nothing compared to the sun. Jesus' garments shone like they were the sun. And then someday I'm looking forward to asking how this all went down. Somehow Peter, James, and John knew that it was Elijah and Moses. Do we get to wear name tags in heaven? Did Jesus call them by name? How does he know they're Moses and Elijah? I don't know. But Peter, in his amazing self-centered perspective, says, let's forget about everybody down there. How about if I build tabernacles and we'll just stay up here forever? You, Elijah, Moses, me, this is great. And then a cloud comes over. And suddenly there's a voice that can be interpreted to be no one other than God the Father speaking. And he says to Peter, this is my son, whom I love. And with him I am well pleased. And then the challenge. Listen to him. I want to challenge you. We're going to spend the next month in the Gospels. I'm trying really hard to get through each book in a Sunday morning. I'm not going to do it when we get to John. I'm just going to up front tell you we're going to take 2 weeks to get through John. For the next month, we're going to be in the four Gospels. I want to challenge you. Would you take a few moments to read through them? The Old Testament, I will admit it's a challenge to get through Jeremiah, Isaiah, Psalms in a week. It's a fair amount of reading. I agree. But the Gospels are way shorter. And in fact, I would suggest that there is no more important information you will ever hear the rest of your life than to hear the life of Christ. But I want to caution you. The Hebrew definition of listen is slightly different than the English definition of listen. We say listen, i.e., hear what I'm saying. A Hebrew perspective on listening is the willingness to take the words and allow them to change how I live. I'm convinced we will never understand Jesus until we start to allow him to transform our lives. And then the rest of our life will be a constant increasing of our ability to hear. For the month of January and into February, I just want to challenge you. Listen to him. Father, I thank you for the chance to open your word. I thank you for the Gospels and the story of your willingness to leave the shelter and the glory of heaven, to clothe yourself in humanity, to subject yourself to the horrific torments of the cross, to die sacrificially and then to rise victorious, and this morning to be seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Thank you. As we listen to you, God, I pray that you would change who we are and that we would be willing to obey and then to share. Father, as we leave this morning, I do pray that you'd give everybody safety on the way home and that you would bring us back next Sunday to learn more of who you are and what you have done for us. For it is in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Be safe. Have a good afternoon.